Ave, and welcome to Emperors of Rome, a podcast about the rulers of the ancient Roman Empire. I'm your host, Matt Smith, and with me as always is Dr. Rhiannon Evans, a lecturer in ancient Mediterranean studies at La Trobe University. This is episode LIX, Martial. Martial was a poet writing in the times of Domitian, Nerva, and Trajan, and I like to think of him as not so much a poet, but perhaps the stand-up comedian of his time. Now, for those of you who are unfamiliar with his work, he was quite a fan of dirty words, and it's important to present these historical figures in an uncensored environment, so his poems will not be bleeped. Consider yourself warned, and please give a warm, upstanding welcome to Martial. Here's Rhiannon Evans.
Martial was a very prolific poet who wrote in the 1st century CE. He wrote a lot of very short poems that we call epigrams, so he's an epigrammist. And he is originally from Spain, but spent a lot of his life in Rome. So he's kind of a token of the way things are changing in the Roman Empire. Mm. So we've got emperors from Spain. We've got writers coming from Spain. We've already talked about Seneca, whose family was from Spain. It's kind of the rise of the West in a way that he's part of. He's very notable at Rome for his fame. And he seems to be part of sort of coterie of late 1st century writers who rise to prominence.
What do we have then that's written by Martial? You said epigrams. What are epigrams?
Epigrams are usually very short poems, and most of his are. They can be as short as two lines, and he wrote a lot of two-liners. Or they might be maybe 20 lines, about the longest. They're usually written in a form which is called the elegiac couplet. These are quite witty, certainly with Martial. They're very witty and zingy. And they will have a longer line and a shorter line.
Okay.
So it's quite a predictable meter and form. So even when he's writing more than two lines, it goes long line, short line, long line, short line. We call it the hexameter and pentameter. Mm. So 6 feet and 5 feet. There are some of Martial's poems that aren't written in that meter, but out of about 1,500, over 1,200 are written in the elegiac couplet. The main ones he's known for are the witty kind of social commentary, and he also writes a couple of books that are about gifts given to people, and a book that's about the games when the Colosseum opened in 80.
But we tend to collect these all in the you've got three Lerb volumes there. That sounds odd.
Yep, they're all collected together and they're all called the epigrams. So three volumes of the Lerbs, which is the parallel text, the Latin and the English, which is more than most people get. We've talked a lot about authors where we've lost bits of their work, or they maybe just didn't live long enough to write very much.
Yeah.
And three is a good body of work to have. He may have written other things too.
Yeah.
There are bits of prose even within those poems. So sometimes there'll be a prose prologue to a book of poetry. But what we've got, as far as we know, represents everything he did. There is a theory that he must have written other things first, because in his first book of poetry, which is written after the book on the spectacles, he talks about being known to everybody, all right, that everybody knows Martial's poetry. So it's likely, yes, he was already established that he'd been writing for a while in Rome, maybe in the 60s CE. But we should bear in mind that Martial is, and he's not alone in this, he's very confident about his poetry. So from the very beginning, from the beginning of book one, he's telling us that he's famous, that people love him, that they have his books in their hands. Sometimes he tells us that they're just little books and, you know, he'll sort of give us this false modesty. But it's pretty clear that it's false modesty.
Yeah.
All right. He's up there with other writers like Catullus. So in the very first poem of book one, he gives us a prologue where he says, don't read this if you're going to be offended by stuff, which is always a great way of making people want to read. Stern Cato's go away, referring back to Cato the censor from Republican times.
People without a sense of humor.
Yeah, who was said to have actually left one of the more popular games, the floral games, because he realized people wouldn't enjoy themselves if he was sitting there being stern. And he's saying, okay, Stern Cato's, get up and leave. We're here to enjoy ourselves.
I like that. Yeah.
But then in the very first poem, it's all about him. And I'll read it all to you. It's just six lines long. You read him, you ask for him, and here he is, Marshall, known the world over for his witty little books of epigrams. Devoted reader, the glory you have given him while he lives and feels comes to few poets in their graves.
Wow, okay.
So that's how he opens. It's the kind of poem that you could imagine comes right at the end of a body of work. But no, he puts it right up front. So, I'm already there. I've made it.
So there's no modesty at all. He's giving himself a round of applause when he comes on stage.
Yeah, and actually putting his name actually in a very prominent place in the line. This is one of the poems that isn't written in elegiacs, but it's right at the end of the line, which is a prominent place in Latin verse. Mm. That line, that second line, contains the words known in the whole world, Marshall. That's the whole line. And I love the kind of brazenness of it, the idea that you appear on the world and say this, I'm here, I've made it, you all want me. He kind of then alternates that with lots of talk about his book, the book of poetry, the physical book of poetry. He talks more about the physical book of poetry than most other poets. And he addresses the book like it's a person. Now, he's not the first to do this. Ovid, for example, had done it a lot in his exile poetry. Marshall, for most of his poetry, he's at Rome, but he talks to the book anyway. And he talks about it like it's a little lost slave or a child being unleashed out into the world. So at the same time as we get that brazen persona, we've also got this idea of a kind of anxiety about how the book's going to fare. So the next poem, I'll just read the beginning, says, "You who want my little books to keep you company wherever you may be and desire their companionship on a long journey, buy these." An implicit anxiety there that people might not buy the books. And he does that a lot. He talks a lot about his book and to his book, and like he has these very protective feelings towards the book, and like it's sometimes like it's a person. Particularly in book three, when apparently he's up in northern Italy, which they call Cisalpine Gaul, so he's technically in Gaul, and he's sending the book back and worried about how it'll get on.
He's
clearly recalling Ovid there.
His children.
It really is like that, and for Ovid too.
The most useful source when we're trying to get information about Marshall's life, whether that matters to his poetry or not, are what we can glean from within some of his epigrams, isn't that?
Yes, we do have this issue with Marshall that we don't have a lot of external information. So we can trawl through his poems, because he does talk about his life, for information, always bearing in mind that he's a poet and he deals in fiction at times, so it may not all be entirely reliable. So, for example, the translator of his poems in the Loeb volume, Sherwin White, who is a great Roman scholar.
That was a fangirl.
He's done the kind of definitive editions of Cicero and Marshall in the Loebs too. He talks about how Marshall mentions his parents in one of his epigrams, and he's inclined to believe the details about his parents. But then another character mentioned in the same poem could well be fictional. So he's trying to draw those distinctions. But to a certain degree, it's all educated guesswork as to whether he's telling us the truth or not.
Yeah, sure. Yeah.
So he tells us that he came to Rome in 64 CE. People have estimated that he was born around 40, because coming in your mid-20s is, you know, that wouldn't be unusual for somebody who with literary aspirations, looking for patronage, looking to make a career. And you kind of have to fill in details around his life from what we know about what was going on at Rome at that time. He might well have had links with somebody like Seneca, who was also from Spain, or at least tried to work that link. In that case, that would have been a very bad moment to do that, because if he arrives in 64, we all know that the following year in 65, Seneca's big fall from grace, he's associated with the Pisonian conspiracy and forced to kill himself. So that link wouldn't have worked out very well for Marshall. He also talks about living in poverty a lot, and that we don't tend to take very seriously, because it's sort of a cliche of poets to talk about, you know, living in a garret, and kind of what we might still associate with poets and writers, that romantic image.
Yeah, it's not a life of luxury.
You have to either be independently wealthy or find a patron in antiquity. But Marshall carried on writing for long enough that he clearly was wealthy enough or patronized enough to be able to continue with it. So, for example, in book eight, he's well established by that point, because they are written certainly to that point in the order that we've got them in. Seven books later, he's giving us epigrams like this in 8, poem 14. I live in a little cell with a window that won't even close, in which Boreas himself would not want to live. Okay, Boreas is the north wind, so that means it's very, very cold.
Yeah, too cold.
Too cold even for the north wind.
Yeah,
yeah. So there's that element of very probably exaggeration.
Mm.
And he often wants you to feel sorry for him in various different contexts, or the poem writes in a way that they've been downtrodden in some way. You know,
yes,
they've been invited to dinner and it's rotten, or, you know, they've been done down by a friend or a woman. So there's that kind of aspect to the epigrammatic persona. An epigram is often associated in Roman genres with the genre of satire, which is a different genre, and it's actually written in epic verse, confusingly, but is much more down to earth than epic poetry and deals with similar kinds of subject matter, everyday events. And when Martial's writing, his very near contemporary is one of our most well-regarded Roman satirists, Juvenal, who Martial actually does mention in his poetry.
Mm.
So he knows of him, and there are clearly overlaps there, even though they're writing in different genres. This is a great time for people doing sort of social commentary through their poetry.
So Martial seems to be quite flippant in his writing, and from what I've seen of it, his style can get a bit personal and attacking, can't it?
Yeah, he does really go for some people.
Mm.
We usually don't know who those people were. It's possible they didn't exist, or they're types. I think we have to assume they're people he could get away with insulting. He doesn't insult the emperor, for example, but he does name names, which is interesting because there is a sort of general feeling in Roman literature that that was something you could get away with during the Republic, but there's less of that happening in the imperial period. People like Juvenal, the satirist I mentioned, actually makes a point of that, of saying, I'm writing satire, but what's the point of it these days? Because we've sort of been castrated by the imperial system. So my predecessors in the Republican period, they could make people quake in their shoes by pointing out the bad things they did.
Yeah.
But we can't anymore. But Martial certainly names names and will point out, you know, people's peccadilloes and really go for the throat, especially in some of his very short poems. So, for example, in Book 3, Poem 87, rumour tells Kiona that you are a virgin and that nothing is purer than your fleshy delights. Nevertheless, you do not bathe with the correct part covered. If you have the decency, move your panties onto your face. So he's kind of combining insult and obscenity there. And there are a lot of poems, and this is true of satire too, that deal with this idea the Romans have of the impure mouth, the os impurum, they call it, because oral sex is always considered dirty and disgusting as a thing to do. And it makes your mouth impure to have done it. And that's what's behind a lot of these poems. You're putting on this front of something, this veneer.
Yeah.
But actually, I can see behind that.
So I've just looked up here, Book 11, Poem 25. Is that how that reference works?
Yes,
in
it
the
is.
Nerb?
Okay. You've gone for Book 11, which is known as the really disgusting one.
Oh, good.
Everyone will rush to that one now.
So this is the equivalent of going to a dictionary and underlining the rude bits.
Yeah, I can see you had a well-spent youth.
Yeah. That overactive cock, well known to girls, not a few, has ceased to stand for Linus. Tongue, look out.
Exactly, and that's pretty much the same principle that, you know.
Wait, you've given me another rude reference here, 1162.
It wasn't me, I didn't do it. So you want me to keep talking about the Linus poem or
Yeah. So what's that one? I mean, you know, rude words aside, what is that referring to? Is that how you said, like, the mouth and that sort of imagery?
Yeah, it contains that illusion within it of the os impurum. There's a lot of this kind of one-upmanship virility going on in these poems. So occasionally Martial or the persona of the poet is the victim, often of impotence or something like that,
is
faced with a really disgusting lover. But often they're accusing other people, or he's accusing other people. And even if the poet doesn't put himself into the poem, there's this idea that, you know, other people are suffering and he's not. And of course, if Linus can't get it up, then he's going to have to use his tongue, which is, you can read into that, that's disgusting because that's the way we feel about that.
This one's terrible. Okay, this is... Book 1162 for those who are reading at home. Lesbia swears that she has never fucked free of charge. It's true. When she wants to be fucked, she is accustomed to pay cash.
Yeah. That's not the translator, Sherwin White, adding in obscenity there.
Yeah, yeah.
All right. The Latin word futuo means I fuck. That's what it means. It is obscene.
Yeah, it's here. Yeah, yeah.
It might be obscene all the way through, as that poem pretty much is. But you get the real insult in the final line, and sometimes even in the second half of the final line. So it's kind of like a joke
that yeah.
you're waiting for the very last part, which you know is going to just kick the victim in the guts.
So was he the equivalent of a stand-up comedian?
Or
an insult comic.
I hadn't really
like
thought
that.
About that, but the way we're talking about it,
yeah
there are aspects of that. And a certain kind of comedian, I guess, who, you know, you talk about some comedians delivering one-liners, so they don't necessarily do the long, rambly narrative that somebody like Eddie Izzard does. They've got a series of very short jokes.
See, Eddie's going to hear that now.
Oh.
Give me book two.
Still in book 11, poem 104, which is one of the longer ones. It's 22 lines long. The very first word is uxor, which means wife. So it's addressed to his wife.
Mm.
Although I have to say, Sherwin White and the first person who really wrote about Marshall in English, John Sullivan, think that he wasn't married.
Yeah.
So this is a construct.
So this is a my wife is so fat joke.
Yeah, it kind of is, but it's going a different direction in that she's so uptight. This is not the wife I want.
Okay.
I want her to have something of the whore about her is what the whole poem is saying. Wife, get out of my house or conform to my ways, goes the first line. I am no curious or numerotatious. And there he's referring to early mythical famous Romans who were very pure and upright.
Mm.
I prefer to sport with a lamp for witness and to admit the daylight when I'm bursting my loins. All right, so he wants to have sex all night is what he's saying. And this goes on and on and on and on, comparing what she wants to what he wants. It comes to, I guess, a climax, we could say, when he says towards the end, you won't let me sodomize. Cornelia used to do that favor for Gracchus, referring to the very famous Roman Republican woman Cornelia, who was married to Gracchus. She was the mother of the Gracchi and known as a kind of, you know, a Roman heroine who was of upright standards. But even she allowed that, according to Marshall, like he'd know. and Julia for Pompey.
Yeah.
There's Julius Caesar's daughter who was married to Pompey. And Porcia Brutus for you. So that's the Portia who was married to Brutus, who was involved in the Roman Civil Wars. He finishes it off, again, with a bit of a zinger, even though it's a longer poem. If grave manners please you, you may be Lucretia all day. At night, I want Lais. You know, you have to know a lot of your Roman historical references there or mythical references. Lucretia was the woman who was raped by the son of the last king of Rome and was so pure that she took her own life and inspired the Roman Revolution that led to the Republic. And when he says, I want Lais, Lais is a typical name for a concubine, a prostitute. So that whole poem is about how she's not the wife he wants.
All right, before we move on, here we go. This is a short one. Book 2, number 42. Zoilus, you spoil the bathtub washing your ass. To make it filthier, Zoilus, stick your head in it. Classy. Classy, classy.
I can see you want to talk about all the poems that are about the impure mouth.
Yeah, well, you know, if I had a highlighter at the moment, I'd just be, yeah, okay. I'd be ruining your lerbs.
One of the reasons that I know an unhealthy amount about this is that my PhD supervisor was Amy Richlin, who wrote the book The Garden of Priapus.
Mm.
Which was basically a word list of all the obscene words in Roman literature. And she was really one of the first people to identify what kind of obscenities were used in Latin, how obscenity worked, and how it worked in quite a violent way in poetry like this. So you have a victim in Marshall, for example. In that book, which is a great book, she looks at the kind of attacking position of the satirist or epigrammist, what's going on there in terms of gender and status and hierarchies. And she used to say that while she was giving talks before and after writing that book, she could tell she'd turn up and they'd say, oh God, the woman who's just going to talk about obscene stuff again is just going to be, you know, half an hour of the fuck word.
Yeah.
I think in the end she'd almost had enough of it. But one of the reasons I know anything about Marshall is from studying with Amy.
All right. So let's move on to everyday life. I'm interested in obscenity aside. What is Marshall telling us about life in Rome?
Well, he tells us a lot. we do always have to bear in mind that there's a great deal of exaggeration and that there are typical scenes. We see them here and we see them in satire as well. And it's a bit like stock characters turn up in plays, which is true of Roman comedy, for example. So one of the characters who turns up, who gets really badly critiqued in these poems, is the character of the legacy hunter, which in Latin is the captator, the person trying to capture money. The stock situation is that this parasitical character will latch on to somebody who has a lot of money but doesn't have heirs.
Right.
So, you know, they'll flatter them and do things for them, especially if they're older. And they usually get criticized. Very occasionally, Marshall will put himself in that position and say, well, you know, I'm not interested in you. You're ugly.
Yeah.
And you're a bit old for me. If you were even older, maybe I would be interested. Buried in that, the idea that he's a captator.
Yes.
He's a legacy hunter too.
Yeah, but he's a strategic one. He's more strategic.
Very much
he's
so.
He's the discerning.
So, for example, Book 11, Poem 44. You are childless and rich and born in Brutus's consulship. In other words, a hell of a long time ago.
Yeah, pretty old, yeah.
Because he was the first consul.
Oh, okay.
In 509 BCE.
All right.
Do you believe you have true friendships? You do have them, but only those you used to have when you were young and poor. Any one of your new friends is fond of your death.
That is harsh.
Yeah, that one's not funny, really, is it? They're not
no,
all funny.
No.
That one has the horrible ring of reality about it.
Mm.
A very typical scene in Marshall is going to dinner or talking about a host, often a bad host. Very occasionally you'll get a description of a good dinner. And often what will happen is the host will be unhostly by hogging all the food or by eating too much themselves. This is one that contains a great pun, which I have to explain the Latin for the pun to make sense, therefore destroying the joke. But I'll do it anyway. Two-liner. This is 7:59. Our friend Caecilianus, Titus, never dines out without aper. A charming dinner guest Caecilianus has. All right, so if you read that,
that's
not
gone
terribly
over my head.
Funny,
yep.
Is it?
Yeah.
All right, so the poem's addressed to Titus, not the Emperor Titus, just an unknown Titus, about our friend who's called Caecilianus, who always goes out to dinner with someone called aper. But the word aper in Latin means a wild boar. All right, and the implication is that he takes his own wild boar with him, you know, a delicacy, and eats the lot of it.
Right.
That's his dinner guest. I know he's eating the guest.
Okay.
So it has kind of layers of...
Had to be there. All right, and speak Latin. I have one here in which Marshall talks about doctors of the time. This is book 5, number 9.
He has a go at doctors in a couple of them. I was out of sorts. But at once you visited me, Symmachus, accompanied by 100 pupils. 100 hands chilled by the north wind touched me. I did not have a fever, Symmachus. Now I do.
So students have cold hands.
The idea that doctors are dangerous runs through his work, and an early one in book 1, poem 47. Just two lines. Diaulus used to be a doctor till recently. Now he's an undertaker. What the undertaker does, the doctor used to do. I think that's probably a well-tried joke now. You know, you might have a setup where a doctor is related to an undertaker and feeding clients to him.
Yeah,
I mean,
yeah.
It's kind of already there in Marshall, the bare bones of it.
Yeah.
Marshall has what we would regard as ethnic jokes, probably not in a good way these days. I'm going to read one from book 10, poem 65, which is a little bit lengthy, but I think worth it. And it's anti-Greek, if you're looking for who he's having a go at here. He says, since you boast yourself a fellow townsman of Corinthian bronzes, in other words, you come from Corinth, with none to gainsay you, no one's talking against you, Comenian, why do you call me brother, born as I am of Iberians and Celts, a countryman of Tagus? I'm not from your part of the world, I'm Spanish. Is it that we look alike? You go around looking smart with your hair in curls, mine is stubborn and Spanish. You are smooth with daily depilatory. My shins and cheeks are hairy. Your mouth lisps and your tongue is feeble. Only Cilia will speak bolder than I. We don't know exactly what that's referring to. A dove is not so different from an eagle or a fugitive doe from a stark lion. So stop calling me brother, Carmenian, in case I call you sister.
So it's a sissy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Softer than him. I mean, taking the hair out is a sign of that.
Yeah, yeah.
to a certain extent now, maybe. I don't know.
So it's ethnic comedy.
Yeah, it is. And he's basically saying, out in the West, we're tough.
Yeah.
You're from that effeminate East. Why do you pretend we've got anything in common?
Mm.
As I say, not very politically correct.
Yes.
I'm not sure we find it quite as funny as the Romans would be rolling around in the aisles. But again, he's doing that virile thing of saying, you know, me being where I'm from, that makes me automatically tougher. And we know we have parallels to that these days, I think. I mean, Australia's probably quite famous for it. We have a very kind of firm sense of Australian masculinity, I think.
So do you think he performed this sort of stuff? Because it really strikes me as stand-up comedy material. It really does.
There are theories that most Roman poetry was much more performed, and even prose, than it was read.
Yeah.
We don't know if people sat and read reams of poetry. And yeah, it lends itself very strongly to that.
Mm. I mean, you could imagine Marshall with a Netflix special, you know, easily. You can imagine him actually really liking Twitter, you know, short, 140 characters. You've got that much to insult someone. Off you go. The other thing that I suppose that he'd have a crack at is government. That'd be fair game, wouldn't it, in his time?
Well,
within reason.
Exactly.
You know, maybe previous emperors are more fair game than the current emperor.
And I keep mentioning this satirist Juvenal, but one of his famous lines at the end of his very first satire, he says he's going to criticize the ones who lie along the Appian Way, in other words, the dead.
Mm.
So there is this idea it's safe to criticize the dead, but not anyone who's around now. And that's certainly true of emperors. So, you know, it's possible that a lot of the people Marshall names really exist.
Yeah.
But he's not going to say that Titus or Domitian are a bad lot.
But he does make reference to them, though, doesn't he?
He does, absolutely. Yeah. And in fact, of course, the book on the spectacles, the one about the arena, is basically a big celebration of Titus. And he is generally complimentary about Titus. You'd expect that. And that doesn't ever go away, even though Titus dies quite young. But then, of course, Titus's brother is the emperor. So you might criticize the dead, but not if their relatives are still in power.
Mm.
And he does talk about Domitian. Book 6, for example, starts with a poem that says that Marshall's very nervous about the poem getting to Domitian and clearly wants him to like it. So 6, poem 1. This, my sixth little book, is sent to you, Martialis, dear to me above all men. If you tidy it with attentive ear, it will dare with less fear and trembling to come into Caesar's mighty hands. So in other words, if you tidy it up a bit, then it can go to Caesar.
Mm.
But, you know, I'm quite nervous about Domitian reading my poetry. And there's a kind of appropriate amount of oh there that the emperor would perhaps deserve. And he talks about Domitian in the second poem. So he's carrying on by talking about Domitian here, specifically referring to Domitian's banning of castration, the creation of eunuchs, and really talking about Domitian as being someone who's very moral. All right, under your rule, no man shall be either eunuch or adulterer, because Domitian also re-strengthened the adultery laws that Augustus had brought in. So he seems to be backing their regime very strongly here.
Yeah.
And if we think Book 6 was probably issued about 90 CE, so this is right in the middle of Domitian's reign, you know, he's playing the party line, very much so.
Yeah.
So it's interesting that when Domitian dies, when he's killed in 96 CE, Marshall does an absolute U-turn on Domitian. He's kind of in an even more invidious position because he's recently put out a book that clearly has very complimentary poems of Domitian. This is Book 10, as we know it now, in 95. So the year before Domitian's death, he's put this book out and he quickly kind of grabs it back and re-releases it a couple of years later. And that's the version we have. So the second edition, which comes out in 98 CE, you know, clearly there were flattering poems to Domitian and these are now got rid of. And instead we have poems that talk about how now we've got this new freedom. This new regime of Nerva and Trajan is the one that set us free from the terrible tyranny. And he talks about no longer do we have to say Lord and God. And I don't know if you remember when we looked at Domitian, we talked about how there was this idea that he demanded people address him as Dominus and Deus.
While he was alive,
and God. And one of the main sources for this is Marshall. So he's clearly making that distinction very clear between the two regimes. He's buying into the new one. He's desperately trying to do this by actually re-releasing a book of poetry. And it's interesting that he either had buried these feelings of antipathy towards Domitian or feels it necessary, maybe a bit of both, feels it necessary to now talk about the new regime in entirely flattering terms. And one of the ways you do that is by criticizing the predecessor.
Mm.
Exactly the same thing that happened after Nero's death, for example. And in 1072, he gives us a longer poem, 13 lines, which really own up to what has happened before, the way that he has praised and adored Domitian. The very first words of it are, "In vain flatteries." There won't be flattery anymore. It was just empty. "Flatteries, you come to me in vain, you poor creatures, with your shameless lips. I am not about to speak of Lord and God. There is no place for you any more in this city. There is no Lord here, but a commander in chief, and the most just of all senators, through whom rustic, dry-haired truth has been brought back from the House of Styx," in other words, the underworld.
Yeah.
So truth was dead while Domitian was here, and now Nerva and Trajan have brought it back to life. So we have liberty, we have truth. "Under this ruler, Rome," he finishes off, "beware, if you are wise, of talking the language of earlier days."
Mm.
So he actually says that his language is going to change now that they've got this freedom and liberty. However, that is probably not borne out by what happened to Martial, because certainly by book 12 in the early 100s CE, he's gone back to Spain. And the theory is, and certainly what John Sullivan and others espouse, is that he actually didn't have a very comfortable life under the Trajanic regime, probably because he'd been far too flattering of Domitian.
Right, yeah.
So it was more comfortable for him to go back home to Bilbilis in Spain, and that's where he died.
Okay.
Probably in about 104.
Did he write much while he was back in Spain?
Well, we've got book 12, yeah, which seems to be written entirely from Spain, where occasionally he complains that it's not very easy to write without his subject matter.
Yeah,
his subject matter being largely the city of Rome and
not
Romans.
Not a lot of inspiration in Spain.
Quieter, yeah. And he sort of talks about that being good, but at the same time. But then, of course, that is also a theme that we see in Ovid from his exile poetry. I don't have the material to write here.
I've lost my muse, yeah.
Although Ovid managed 9 books of it.
Give me a poem, one of Martial's works, just to sign off the podcast. Something good.
I get the impression here that Martial actually can have a little perspective on his works and realises, even in book 1, that he's produced an awful lot of poems.
Yeah, yeah.
Because this is from book 1 and it's poem 118. It's the final poem of the book. And this poem, it's just a two-liner. "He for whom reading 100 epigrams is not enough will never have enough of a bad thing."
That's Dr. Rhiannon Evans, lecturer in Ancient Mediterranean Studies at La Trobe University. And you've been listening to Emperors of Rome. If you like this podcast, please subscribe to it on iTunes and please leave a review there. You can like this podcast on Facebook and you can follow both myself and Rhiannon on Twitter. Rhiannon is at Dr. Rhiannon Evans, and I'm at Nightlight Guy. In the next episode of Emperors of Rome, you'll hear a recording from our live show coming soon to the Wheeler Centre in Melbourne. We'll be talking about Cleopatra, her relationship with Rome, Caesar, and Mark Antony, and I will be wearing my toga. But until then, I'm Matt Smith, you've been fantastic, and thanks for listening.